From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, transforming a decayed building into something useful like housing for homeless veterans.
Toughest part of the process is to ask city officials if they're going to support the project. If you don't have the city support, it will not move forward.
A new choral work with the last words of seven unarmed black men killed by police and others.
I wanted to make sure that what I wrote was true to my internal pain and reaction to all of the racial tension going on, but also true to the victims themselves.
And why did the vice chair of the State Board of Canvassers dash out just before a vote?
The fact that he had come and then left just was quite an abrupt halt to the meeting.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome, I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, the keys to 27 beautifully renovated new apartments were handed over to veterans and people who are homeless or disabled, thanks to a $6 million renovation of an abandoned building near Midtown Detroit. Cities and towns across the state have more unused buildings than most of us can count. You ever go past one, maybe on your commute to work every day, and think, how can we clean that thing up and put it to good use in our community? Later this hour, we'll talk with the expert who helped make this Detroit project a reality and find out how he does it. Here's a hint. It's not easy. But first, a planned vote on a controversial 180-day signature window on gathering signatures for statewide petition drives came to a rather abrupt and bizarre end Monday. MLive's Emily Lawler was covering a meeting of the State Board of Canvassers where a vote was supposed to happen. She is with us now. First of all, Emily, tell us why this signature window, this 180 days, is kind of controversial.
Yeah, you know, it hasn't been for many years. After 180 days of gathering signatures for a petition drive, those signatures past 180 days old were presumed stale. And some petition gatherers this time around kind of dug up an old procedure and said, wait a second, we can rebut that. We can prove that the signatures are still valid. But the issue is that the rules for doing that were established in 1986. They're outdated. And what these people, which are the pro-marijuana petition and the anti fracking petition, would like to do is be able to rebut the staleness of their signatures more easily through using the electronic qualified voter file.
And that comes under the purview of the State Board of Canvassers.
Yes. So the State Board of Canvassers would have to make a rule change within their own procedures so that people circulating petitions and groups circulating petitions could rebut more easily through using the qualified voter file instead of going and getting affidavits from very local clerks on every single one of these signatures.
What happened Monday then, Emily, when it was time for the State Board of Canvassers to take a vote on these revisions?
There were two things on the agenda for the meeting. One was these revisions, which was the second agenda item. The other one was a recall petition for Governor Rick Snyder, and they approved the recall petition as to form and said that the language was clear. And then one of the Republican board members was not present at the meeting. She had a prior engagement in relation to the Flint water crisis. And then the other Republican board member, Norm Schinkel, kind of left very abruptly, and then the chair said, this meeting's over. We don't have a quorum.
Boom. That was that. Now, and you actually ran out after Schinkel, after he left the room?
Yeah. You know, I had a brief moment of indecision, and I said that I thought the story would be wherever Mr. Schinkel was. I wanted to see why he had left. So yeah, I ran out and followed him and ended up getting an elevator ride's worth of conversation.
And in that elevator ride, your story for MLive's, did you fluster him so much that he got off on the wrong floor, Emily Lawler?
You know, I can't take credit. I get tricked by those elevator buttons as much as anyone else. But yeah, he did get off at the first floor and then realized he had to get back in the elevator with me, which I assume wasn't super pleasant for him. But, you know, I was able to get some questions answered, and I think that it's some important context around what happened at the meeting.
Indeed. And what did you ask, and what did he say?
Yeah, well, I opened with, do you have a minute? And he said, no, I don't have a minute. That's why he was leaving, as he was crunched for time. So he told me he had a client meeting he had to get to with a client that he didn't want to lose. So, you know, I kind of was in the position of taking that at face value, but then asked him about this 180-day policy. And his opinion is that the legislature is dealing with it. There's a bill out there right now that would solidify a 180-day window, not let anyone rebut older signatures and bring them back to life. So his opinion was that it was in the legislature and they're dealing with it.
Therefore, for the marijuana group, for Am I Legalized, or for the anti-fracking group, too bad?
If the legislation were to pass, I talked with Elections Director Chris Thomas, who works with the state, and he said that if the bill were to pass, there wouldn't really be a need to revisit this policy because the staff had made a recommendation and they wouldn't be putting forward another recommendation if the law had already changed on that policy.
How often have you seen an official scoot out of a meeting, dash out of a meeting, apparently to, keep a vote from happening?
Not too often. I mean, there are always people who have to leave because they have another committee starting or another engagement to get to. But, you know, this was a pretty nebulous engagement. And, you know, the fact that he had showed up and voted for part of the meeting, which they're required to vote on those recall petition matters within a certain time frame. So the fact that he had come and then left just was quite an abrupt halt to the meeting.
MLive's Emily Lawler. Emily, thanks for giving us a little hint as to how the sausage is made in Lansing.
Thanks for having me.
How prepared is our state to respond to a health emergency? The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is out with its 2016 National Health Security Preparedness Index, and it has some answers. This is the third year for the index. It helps the states and nation figure out just how well we're doing in emergency preparedness and health security. With us now is Glenn Mays from the University of Kentucky. He and his team manage the National Health Security Preparedness Index. Glenn, before we hear how Michigan fared, tell us what the index is measuring.
Great. Well, thanks for letting me be with you today. The National Health Security Preparedness Index provides a yardstick for measuring a broad constellation of activities that can protect health and safety in the face of disasters and other large-scale health emergencies. So really measures a large number of activities that research and experience has shown to help protect population health when we face emergencies.
Such as, give us an idea of the kinds of emergencies that we're preparing for.
These could be storms. These could be weather-related events. They could be fires and floods. They could be infectious disease outbreaks or problems with infrastructure that create environmental hazards in our water or food supply.
What are some of the measures in the index?
Well, the index integrates more than 130 measures across nearly 60 different data sources to give, a broad view of what we know through research and experience can be useful to protect health and safety. So it measures what public health agencies can do on the front lines of surveying the population to get an early warning signs for potential health problems. It measures what healthcare providers can do to continue to offer high quality and timely healthcare during and after emergency events. It measures what emergency management agencies can do to help manage the early acute phases of responding to diseases and outbreaks and other kinds of emergencies.
And it's a 10-point scale. So how did Michigan do in the 2016 index?
Michigan has made substantial progress and really very much tracks the nation overall when it comes to overall levels of preparedness and health security. The overall index score for Michigan stood at 6.5 in this latest round of the index, and that represents about a 2.5% improvement since 2013 for the state of Michigan. And again, that's very much in line with the trajectory that we see for the nation as a whole.
And what are Michigan's main strengths, would you say?
One of its major strengths lies in the area of surveillance, being able to use existing data systems to detect potential problems and health threats that pop up in the population across Michigan so that the state can generate early responses to those potential health threats. Michigan really leads the nation in the area of health security surveillance. Another key area of strength for Michigan lies in some of its environmental and occupational health protections that, again, are very important for preventing emergencies and also for mobilizing early responses to those threats to air or water or food safety.
And how about the flip side of the coin? Where do we need to work? Where's improvement needed?
One of those areas is in the area of community planning and engagement, which has to do with bringing together all the relevant organizations, both in government and the private sector, and getting them to plan and share their plans for responding to emergencies and disasters. We know, again, through lots of research over the decades that having strong community planning and engagement mechanisms in place, strong communication mechanisms across public and private sector agencies that play a role here, very important in preventing emergencies, but also very important in responding and bouncing back quickly from from disasters and other emergencies. And that's an area where, Michigan seems to be lagging the nation somewhat in that community planning and engagement domain.
Did much of what happened in Flint, where there was a complete breakdown, and even worse, between, say, state agencies and what was going on at the local level, that really helped lead to poisoning the city of Flint with lead-tainted water, did that hurt Michigan's overall index? Was that considered?
Well, that's a good question, and the index can't really track exact, you know, kind of cause and effect relationships with regard to disasters and emergencies, and so we can't say with any certainty whether they're, you know, measured in the index or tracking closely with the events that precipitated the Flint water crisis. Nevertheless, there certainly are measures here that offer some clues for why the events may have played out, and especially offer some clues for ways that kind of event might be prevented in the future. And again, I think the area of community planning and engagement, which I mentioned, is one of the areas of potential vulnerability for Michigan, is likely to be quite relevant to some of the events that played out there. Another domain, again, where Michigan kind of lags a bit behind the rest of the nation is in the area of incident and information management, the ability to implement standardized protocols for responding to disasters and emergencies in that acute phase of the disaster and emergency response activities. And that's obviously a set of activities that would be very relevant to what's played out with the water crisis.
Indeed. Glenn Mays leads a research team at the University of Kentucky in managing the National Health Security Preparedness Index. The latest index, the 2016 one, is out today from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Glenn, it was great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's never a good idea to get complacent about tornadoes. Mother Nature and all her fury is nothing to trifle with, which is why the state recently held a statewide tornado drill. Let's talk tornadoes now with MLive.com and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. Mark, we think of tornado season as April or May for places like Oklahoma and Texas. But when is Michigan's tornado severe weather season typically?
Well, if you had to say the most common month, June would be the peak of tornado season in Michigan, but we have had some of our worst tornadoes in April and May and in July, too. So I guess you got to consider anywhere from April through July would be your main threat for tornadoes. And the Michigan tornadoes are interesting because we've had some strong, violent tornadoes in weather that the typical tornado alley wouldn't consider having a tornado. And we've had tornadoes when temperatures are in the 40s and 50s. And down there, they would not develop just because of the different weather situations that happen here in Michigan.
In fact, you use that term tornado alley. We have all heard it, but I'm guessing a lot of us don't know exactly what it means. What is that, and do we have tornado alleys in Michigan?
Well, the main U.S. tornado alley is, again, just kind of a general area from Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas into Iowa. Doesn't mean that Missouri and Illinois aren't in that too, but they're kind of on the edges of it. Now in Michigan, I have done some studies and looked at the tornado tracks, and I've actually found, you know, unofficially a few tornado tracks or tornado alleys pretty much right along I-69 from the Lansing area through Flint to east of Flint. That one really sticks out as a very common one. When you look at the amount of tornadoes that Genesee County has had, it's much higher than the counties just to the south, like Oakland County, and it's much higher than counties just to the north.
And we don't know really why?
I think it's a lay of the land and the way the Great Lakes are shaped. What typically spawns a tornado in Michigan or helps get one going is a lake breeze and what we call wind shear at the ground. And so oftentimes the lake breeze in a thunderstorm situation has come off of the thumb and off of Lake Huron and Saginaw Bay, sits down around I-69, and then here comes a strong to severe storm across the state from west to east. It hits that lake breeze, and that causes the rotation and causes a tornado to develop.
Now, we are a few months away from what you feel is kind of the peak of tornado or severe weather season, but any early indications, anything pointing to give you an idea of whether we're going to have a rough storm season this year?
Well, I think we could. You know, in your worst tornado year, you're probably only going to, in Michigan, have a couple of handfuls of tornadoes. But what I will say about this year is you've seen the weather pattern we've been in. We have had decent-sized, strong storm systems, especially in March and early April when we got kind of back into that storm track. And we're on the warm side of those storms now. So I would say there could be a pretty decent chance at significant severe weather in Michigan this May and June, unless the storm track would die down and the jet stream would die down, which that can also happen. But my mind right now, I think we got to be prepared for something maybe a little more potent than normal coming up here in the next few months.
And with that in mind, I guess you can never pass the word along enough. What should folks do to be prepared for a tornado if and when it happens in their area?
Well, you definitely need to know where you're going to go in your house, where you work, where you play outside. Now, before a tornado hits, because you probably only have about 1 to 2 minutes to make up your mind between the time you're convinced that you've got a life-threatening situation and that life-threatening situation hits you.
Boy, the way you put that, when we hear the warning, take cover, what you just spelled out, I think it's got us all, it should have us all thinking, you know what, don't shrug that off.
Right. Well, and the problem, too, is about 70% of tornado warnings have a false alarm. But the thought is you better overwarn for storms that could become tornadic rather than underwarn. And now in the last couple of years, the philosophy from the Weather Service that issues the warnings has been, let's be a little bit stingier with the warnings, and it's kind of helped the false alarm ratio a little bit better. But the thing is, what do we do in Michigan? 9 out of 10 people, when there's a tornado warning issued in Michigan, instead of going to the basement like they should, they go out onto their porch and see if they can finally see one of those things.
That's a good warning. We don't really want to see one of those things.
No, you don't. And you should not go out onto your porch and try to see the tornado. You should be heading to your basement when there's a warning. The warnings are getting better all of the time, and they're becoming more advanced. So, for example, if we had a tornado like the 1950s tornado from Flint, we would know about that because of Doppler radar and because of our technology. We would know about that about 30 minutes to 45 minutes in advance. So if you were in the Flint Beecher area and that same situation was happening today, you would have a warning in place 45 minutes in advance, and all of the media would be playing almost like play-by-play, almost like a high-speed chase. The tornado is here now, the tornado is here now, the tornado is here now. And if you didn't know about it a half hour in advance, you really are under a rock or something.
You've given us lots to think about. As always, great to talk with you. Mark Torregrosso, the meteorologist for MLive.com and FarmerWeather.com. Thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The names of men like Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and others have been thrust into our nation's history. African-American men who were all unarmed and all killed by authority figures. These deaths gave rise to the Black Lives Matter movement and to badly needed discussions about racial discrimination and social injustice. This spring, the University of Michigan Men's Glee Club added its voice in a singular way to this national conversation. The Glee Club's spring performance featured the premiere of a multi-movement work called The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. It is written by Atlanta-based composer Joel Thompson. It uses the final words of seven African-American men who were unarmed and, as we said, shot and killed by authority figures. With us now is composer Joel Thompson. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Joel.
Thank you.
And we welcome the Associate Director of Choirs and Associate Professor of Conducting at the University of Michigan, Eugene Rogers. It is very good to have you with us.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Joel, such a powerful and extremely emotional idea. When and how did you get this concept of creating this one piece using those seven sets of last words?
I wrote the piece in the winter of 2014 while teaching at a 2-year college in South Georgia
In addition to that, I was also working on a very emotional school play, Master Harold and the Boys by Athol Fugard, and that put me in an emotional space that didn't prepare me for another tragedy of hearing the grand jury fail to indict the officer whose actions led to the death of Eric Garner. And with that sort of perfect storm of emotions, a colleague sent me the pictograms that Shirin Bargi was posting on Twitter, the stark images paired with the quotes of these unarmed men. And my colleague suggested that I should make a musical version of that. And so here we are.
And how long did it kind of pour out? Was it hard to write? What was the process like?
Yes, it was 4 weeks of straight writing. It was intense. I definitely did a lot of research before I solidified anything and wrote a single note. I wanted to make sure that what I wrote was true to my internal pain and reaction to all of the racial tension going on, but also true to the victims themselves. I wanted to make sure that everything was correct, that I understood the situation and the context around their deaths, and hopefully that would lead to an authentic composition.
A very heavy responsibility for the writer and also for the performers. And Eugene, I want to ask you, how did the Michigan Men's Glee Club become involved with this?
So Joelle, the summer, I guess the summer 2015, in June of 2015, was workshopping the piece in Atlanta. And a friend of mine was involved in this sort of works in progress rehearsal and said, you must hear this piece. What I know about you and how you work with the Michigan Men's Glee Club, I think it would be of interest to you. And he connected Joelle and I, and Joelle then sent me a copy of the score. And it was at that time that I knew it was powerful. I knew just immediately from reading through it, it spoke to me, but I struggled quite a bit because my thoughts were, I teach at a university where, of course, we welcome discourse and all sorts of diverse thoughts. However, I direct an ensemble that's 100 college men who are not predominantly African-American, even though it's diverse, but still predominantly white men. And I don't want them to feel as if this is against them or against policemen. How can we approach this so that we all are together and unified and that this is not my message or a couple of students in the group's message, but our message.
So how did you
and
reconcile
yourself?
And so
from that, through that process, I began to focus on the theme of love, life, and loss came to me. And I knew that even if we didn't agree politically on cause and who's to blame and or whatever, that hopefully we could all agree on the value of each of these men's lives, that we honoring lost lives. And that's from that point, we began to focus on honoring lost lives, and the response from the students, though many of them had their own journey, the response was quite positive.
Joel, I'd like to, before we continue talking about the piece, would you give us the words and who spoke them? Would you tell us what those phrases are that you used?
Yes. Officers, why do you have your guns out? Kenneth Chamberlain. What are you following me for, Trayvon Martin? Mom, I'm going to college, Amadou Diallo. I don't have a gun, stop shooting, Michael Brown. You shot me, Oscar Grant.
You shot me, you shot me, you shot me.
It's not real, John Crawford. I can't breathe, Eric Garner.
These are extremely powerful words. And I can see where, Eugene, you kind of felt like, wow, I want to make sure that we're all coming from the same place. And I get the feeling from things I've heard you say, Joelle, this is really not about being political, more about confronting and beginning to talk about racial discrimination and social injustice?
Yes. Well, for me, I wrote the piece without the intention of it really being performed. It was really a method for me to process my own feelings and sort of exorcise the emotions in a healthy way. And the main reason that it's uncomfortable to have this conversation is that it's uncomfortable to step into another person's shoes and acknowledge all of the pain and the raw negative feelings concerning those issues. And so by having these last words being sung, that the audience, not only the audience, but also the performers, would have that experience of stepping into those shoes and just acknowledging the humanity of these people that many times the media and the layperson would dismiss as thugs or gangsters or almost justifying their death. By just hearing the last words of "Mom, I'm going to college," you have to confront that person's humanity before you do anything else.
And Eugene, I got to imagine for these student performers, and as you say, many of them are white. You've got a diverse group, but what was that like watching them do exactly what Joelle described, to put themselves, you know, in the position of a Trayvon Martin or, you know, what did you see happen?
You know, I intentionally try to allow those words to speak for themselves. That's the first thing. And this is why, in addition to that, I added as a paired piece to follow this was John Legend's In Common's Glory.
From the film Selma.
From the motion picture Selma, because I also knew that I wanted them to see that there is a process here that we can offer. As we go through this journey, there's still hope. Though we have this current state of crisis and issues that we need to deal with, we believe, again, we can value human life, and we believe that if we come together and at least dialogue, you know, and that's what I saw happen, where students starting to have conversations about this in a way that maybe was difficult, and performing it. I have to talk about it. Yeah. I am always talking about you must be true to whatever your story you're telling. We must be true to that story. And they moved me, to be frank, at how much they fully gave themselves to performing these words and telling those stories. It has produced something that's far more than I ever imagined.
And I'm sure this is your hope as audiences hear this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, Joelle, when you were deciding, all right, I will let the Michigan Men's Glee Club perform this piece that I didn't think was going to be performed. What was that like for you, hearing these young men give life to your composition?
That was an incredibly moving experience. I knew from conversation with Dr. Rogers and just getting to know him that I had entrusted this piece to the right person.
Thank you.
Looking back, I feel so blessed and lucky that it found its way into his hands. The way in which he organically allowed the piece to become real and honest to the men of the Glee Club was just amazing.
Joelle Thompson is the composer of The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. Eugene Rogers is the Associate Director of Choirs and Associate Professor of Conducting at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much to both of you for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The University of Michigan Men's Glee Club will be going to South Africa this month. Before they leave, they'll premiere a 30-minute documentary about the songs we've been talking about, Seven Last Words of the Unarmed and Glory. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. on the U of M campus. The screening is free and open to the public. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been 25 years now since the rape and murder of a young woman in her college dorm room led Congress to pass the landmark Clery Act. This federal law requires colleges and universities to report on-campus crime data so parents and students can make informed choices, especially when making housing decisions. But off-campus crime is not required. Should it be? Is it even logistically possible? With us now is Allison Kiss. She's executive director of the Clery Center for Security on Campus. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
A recent in-depth story in the Lansing State Journal and the Arizona Republic caught our eye digging into crime data from Michigan State University, the University of Arizona, and Arizona State, and showed there are far more crimes happening off-campus than on. Do you believe the act needs to be changed to include off-campus crime?
Unfortunately, I don't know if it's possible to change the act to include off-campus crime just because of the jurisdictions at place and really truly not understanding where all of the students live. They may live at home with parents. They may choose apartments in different cities. So I don't know if we can fully capture all of those numbers. However, the act already includes rights for students who report victimization, whether it's on or off campus. And to me, that's the most important thing. While we may not capture the number, we're making sure that we're caring for that student and presenting them with options and resources to help them through that.
I'm thinking of just one example, and it made a lot of headlines here in Michigan when we had two Michigan State students shot by a man who was trying to steal a laptop. One of those students, who was a 20-year-old sophomore, died. But the law didn't require the MSU police to report his murder because it happened in an off-campus apartment. And as a parent, boy, I'd like to know that.
Absolutely. And I think that what we've seen are a lot of colleges and universities who have gone above and beyond. And it's one of our mantras at the Clery Center is to look beyond the letter of the law and embrace the spirit. So we've seen campuses that will warn students if there's anything that poses a threat, even if it's not on campus. So that could be anything from car thefts to if students live in a public apartment building and they've received certain reports or disclosures of things happening, still making sure they're providing kind of awareness updates to students about those. And I think that's a best practice and what the law's all about. It's about care for students.
And I would suspect logistically the challenges of trying to report off-campus crime are many because now it isn't just campus police. You could have several police agencies involved.
Absolutely. I think when you're thinking about students who are not living on the campus, you can't always monitor where those students are living and capture that 100%. And so there, I think, would be a flaw in trying to collect that data. And I do think we get that data from places like the Bureau of Justice Statistics, where we can get a sense that where crime is happening. It's also a good indicator to me that there's not as much crime happening on campus, and I think that's largely because of the systems in place that we see on campus.
And therefore, we see this kind of big gap between on-campus crime and off-campus crime, because you're saying things are that much better on campus.
If anything, it's an argument when you're a parent and you're looking, look at an institution. Do they have a four-year residency requirement or availability for on-campus housing for 4 years? I think that's certainly something that you need to take into account when you're looking at colleges and universities for your student. I know often we hear of students renting off-campus apartments or housing that may not be up to code, whether it be fire safety or other codes. So I think there are certainly a number of variables you want to consider, crime being one of them, when moving off-campus. And that data is available from local police departments or the local jurisdiction.
In fact, take us a little more into that, Allison, because that's your mission at the Clery Center for Security on Campus, is getting these students through school and out into the world without becoming the victim of a crime. So what do you tell parents and future students? How do they go about making that informed decision?
Sure. Our founder, Connie Clery, often said to be forewarned is to be forearmed. And it is true. I think that the more proactive you are about learning about safety, security, about what services are available to you, the better. The more that you know where to go to get help if something happens, what type of prevention programs exist. If you're looking for off-campus housing, see if your university has an off-campus housing office where they can talk with you about some of the places that are available. They can identify if there has been a fire there, if there have been any challenges there when it comes to safety. I think that many campuses have these resources, and unfortunately, they are often underutilized. And as an organization, we're pushing people to be proactive because, again, unfortunately, we've heard too many stories after something happens, and they can be tragic. So it's something that we need to think about.
Do you have resources on your website for families?
we do have resources under education. We have something called National Campus Safety Awareness Month. That is an awareness month that runs in September, but the material is up there all year long. And it includes a number of tools and training around anything from dating violence to study abroad and campus safety to sexual assault. So those tools are available.
Parents and students can go to clerycenter.org, and that's C-L-E-R-Y, clerycenter.org, and take advantage of those resources. Allison Kiss, who is the executive director of the Clery Center, and I'm sure you are aware all the time in the work you do of 19-year-old Jean Clery, where this really all began with her murder.
We actually walk up our stairs every day, and we have a portrait of Jean, and it really inspires us in the work that we do for the many students out there who are just like Jean.
Allison, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
It was not that long ago when the historic Charlotte apartment building in Detroit's Cass Quarter was a decaying hotbed of crime, drug dealing, prostitution. Those days are gone. Today, the once festering building a block northwest of the Masonic Temple becomes a new home for homeless veterans and people with disabilities. Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan was there today dedicating the newly renovated building. It boasts 27 one-bedroom apartments with granite countertops, stainless steel appliances, homes. The $6.1 million renovation was shepherded through by Detroit's Central City Community Mental Health, working with Union Capital Development. There are so many unused buildings all through Michigan that could be turned into something positive like this for their communities. So let's see what it took to make this transformation happen. Bob Sincer is with us now. He's the president of Union Capital Development. Good to have you with us, Bob.
Thank you.
This is a startling transformation from what this building was not long ago.
Amazing what can be done with a stroke of the architect's pen.
Give us an idea of how bad things had gotten with this once, you know, very solid 1920s vintage apartment building.
Well, the building was very deteriorated. The roof had blown off. The windows were all out of the building. So it was wide open to the weather conditions and really a blight to the area.
Now, there's so much more to this than driving by a derelict building day after day and then saying, hey, let's fix it up and turn it into affordable housing, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And fortunately, Detroit Central City had the vision to do supportive housing in that particular building. Basically, what that means is that they would have tenants that had special needs. They were either homeless or they had some physical and or mental impairment and would need continuing supportive services as they occupied the building. So they wanted a building where they could actually provide those services because that is their line of business.
So they have the vision, but they need someone like you and Union Capital Development to actually make it happen.
From a financial perspective, that's correct. Basically, I come in with a development team that I use most of the projects that I have. Development team consisting of the architect, a contractor, environmental specialist, market study organization, appraisal organization, and a management company to manage the end product once it's built out and leased up. So I bring that team to the table, and then I embark on finding finances for the project in order to make it happen. So once we determine what the cost is going to be for construction and all the soft costs involved in developing a project, I then know the dollar amount of sources that I need in order to do that. So I start out on that process. Usually, the primary source of funding in these projects is what they call low-income tax credits.
We've heard that term.
Low-income tax credits are credits that are issued from the federal government to every state based on their per capita. These credits are provided to the housing authorities in the respective states. And then those credits are accessed by a competitive process. We file applications to compete to get those credits, we being developers that want to use that money as equity money.
So if this was a commercial development, you'd be going to the bank and getting a loan.
Exactly.
But this is the kind of equivalent and the government helping you put together this deal.
Yes, because these create equity. These are dollar-for-dollar credits that corporations can use to offset their income tax liability on a dollar-for-dollar basis, as I said. They're purchased by a syndicator who represents the corporations that actually use the credits. The syndicators pay so much on the dollar for the credits. Let's say, for example, today the market is 93 cents on the dollar. So 93 cents comes in to the project as equity. The spread between the 93 cents and the dollar is actually creating the internal rate of return for the investor slash syndicator. So that's their motivation to do it. So the money comes in as equity, so we don't have debt service like a market rate development would have. Therefore, we can charge lower rents. That enables us to charge lower rents.
Bob, you said it was a competitive process. What are some of the criteria that they're looking at to determine if your project is deserving of low-income housing credits?
Well, the state of Michigan has what they call a qualified allocation plan. And within that plan, they state the various aspects of the project that they're looking for. For example, walkability. You know, where is the project located? Is it close to shopping? Is it close to medical? Is it close to schools? They're looking for city support. You know, does the city actually support the project? Are they going to provide some form of tax abatement, which is always needed in these types of projects? Are they going to provide home funds for the project, which are HUD monies that come into each of the cities to use for affordable housing? So they're looking for city support. They're looking for amenities. You know, is the project going to have washer dryers, stove refrigerators? Is it going to be good quality housing? That gets points. If it's an historic building, that will get extra points. If it's a nonprofit, that will get extra points. So it's a point system, and how well the project scores out will depend on whether or not they're competitive enough to actually receive the credit. So the higher the score, the better the project is, supposedly, from the eyes of the state, and they will allocate the project tax credits.
It certainly seems like renovating the Charlotte apartment building and turning it into housing for homeless veterans and people with disabilities, historic, but it seems to tick a lot of the boxes.
Yes.
And the fact that you got it and this is opening up shows that it. But how long did it take you to put together all of the pieces to get this project going?
Approximately 18 months is the normal turnaround time. You know, once you file your tax credit application, it's like a 90-day period before you find out if you have the credits. Then usually you will start your drawings, prepare the scope, plans, and specs. That's another 90 days. You know, then you have to get your building permits. And in the interim, it's not just tax credits, you know, that are used to finance these projects. Depending on the project, there are different sources that would be available. So I mentioned home funds earlier. There is community development block grant money also provided by the government. In this particular case, we had a Home Depot $300,000 grant that they put in because it was a veterans project. So it was because it had that aspect to it, they put in that. We also accessed brownfield credits. Now, this was before the state did away with the Michigan business tax because prior to that, you could get brownfield credits and then sell those to individual investors to create equity. But since the state no longer has that, this was grandfathered in because we had the credits prior to. So those are monetized. If the building's historic, you'll get federal historic credits. Again, those are sold to create additional equity into the projects.
I'm hearing so many ways to shake the tree to get money into the pot to do this project. So this is clearly not for the uninitiated. In fact, I think I read your funding application was 4 inches thick.
Yes, that's the binder
that's
that goes
something.
In for the process.
What's the maybe toughest, most challenging or frustrating part of the process? I'm thinking of people who may have an idea and want to get to where you and the team have.
Well, the toughest part of the process is to, first of all, decide and ask city officials if they're going to support the project. If you don't have the city support, it will not move forward.
This is a complicated process, clearly. Is that complicated process preventing decaying buildings from being renovated and turning into badly needed affordable housing?
Well, I think, you know, it's a specific process that has to occur in various segments. The challenge is basically to make sure the market is there so when the project is finally constructed, you have tenants that are going to be able to occupy and are available to occupy the units. In tax credit projects, you specifically have a market that's limited because of affordability. A tax credit project cannot have a tenant whose income exceeds 60% of the area median income level. So if they make More than that, they are not allowed to live in the project. So you have to make sure that tenants that are in that market, you know, reside in the area so that they would be able to occupy the units. Students cannot occupy these projects, so even though they're making less money, they can't occupy. And the AMIs can be lower than that. That's the max. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, projects are stratified so that we have rents from the 40% to 45%, 50%, 55%. So we have different levels of AMI in the respective building. So we might have so many units at each level. This then allows us and assures us more that it will lease up.
Since you're one of a handful of people in the state who really can do what you do, you know this process. Are there things that you think could be done to streamline it or make it easier so that we could get more of these abandoned buildings turned around and breathe new life into them?
Well, unfortunately, the process is complicated. It always has been. And I think it is that for a reason, because if everyone could do it, you know, we would have projects possibly starting and then not finishing construction because they weren't funded properly. We could have projects that were completed and then not able to be leased up. We could have projects that are leased up, but they don't have the proper management company, so rents aren't being collected, the project goes into default. So there's a chance a failed project that's much greater if, in fact, it isn't structured properly. So I think that's why it is complicated, and there are only so many of us out there that really know how to structure these projects to make sure they're successful.
When you think about what it took and the work you did to make this happen, what does it mean when you see people that had served their country as vets, had fallen on hard times, no place to live, and now they have a home?
I have had tenants come up to me saying, thank you so much. You know, I was living in a homeless shelter. I was living, you know, in substandard conditions, say a single woman with children, and now they have housing that they can afford. And so it's just an ongoing stream, and the people are very appreciative of what you're providing for them. It's amazing.
It is an exciting development. Bob Zinser is president of Union Capital Development and working with Detroit Central Community Mental Health. They are opening the door to housing for homeless vets in Detroit's Cass Corridor in the historic Charlotte apartment building. Congratulations on a fantastic project that's really going to do good in the community, Bob.
Thank you so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.